Welcome to Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Technical problems affecting the state's new healthcare exchange, known as Vermont Health Connect, are starting to become a political issue for Governor Peter Shumlin. Shumlin has vowed to fix these problems in the near future, and he says he has a contingency plan in case the problems continue, but he says it's much too soon to talk about these plans.
I continue to be absolutely confident that Vermont Health Connect will work effectively for Vermonters. I appreciate the patience of Vermonters, and we will get this right. If we need contingency plans, if some part of it won't work exactly the way we want, we'll be prepared to deal with that.
Can these problems be fixed in time for at least 75,000 people to enroll by the end of the year? And what kind of backup plan should the state put in place in case the technical glitches with the exchange aren't totally fixed? These are some of the questions we have today for someone who's following this issue closely, and that's Lieutenant Governor Phil Scott. Lieutenant Governor, welcome to the program.
Well, thanks for having me on.
Great to have you back. You can join the conversation here at Vermont Edition. Give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Are you concerned about the technical problems involving Vermont Health Connect, or do you think perhaps these problems are being blown out of proportion because big computer projects of this kind often have some glitches at the start? Perhaps there are other key issues you would like to discuss with Lieutenant Governor Phil Scott. This is a great opportunity to do it. 1-800-639-2211, or send us an email at vermontedition@vpr.net. So Vermont Health Connect has been up and operating for about 3.5 weeks. Some people are still encountering some technical problems. State officials are hoping that the online payment system, which isn't working now, will be working by the end of next week, by perhaps November 1st. Give me your general thoughts about all these issues surrounding Vermont Health Connect. What do you think?
Well, as you know, I've been on the program before and talked about some of the skepticism I had about rolling out this huge endeavor, about putting 100,000 people online by January 1, I thought was an uphill battle. And I just think that, you know, the reality is that's an incredible feat to accomplish. And I think that we're seeing that the IT glitches that we've had both here in the state and nationally are coming, are a reality, and we have to deal with them. So I just think that we've got to take the conversation and not turn this into a blame game. We've seen what happens in Washington when this happens, when one side tries to blame the other for issues that we face. And once we draw the lines in the sand, once we try and make something into a partisan battle, we all lose. And this is far too important to do that. I'm not saying that I don't see problems with the Affordable Care Act itself. I think many of us do, but it is the law. And as an elected official, I think it's my job to respect and uphold the law, which is while at the same time making sure that all of us are kept in mind as we progress. So
this week, House Minority Leader Don Turner and Senate GOP Leader Joe Benning offered a plan, and basically they said, hey, there is a provision in Act 171, that's the law that set up the healthcare exchange, that allows people to continue to get their insurance the way they do right now outside of the exchange if the exchange is not fully operational by January 1st. That's what's in the law. So they said, hey, if this thing isn't working by December 1st, then the governor should invoke that waiver until the whole system is working the way it's designed. Does that make sense?
Well, I think it does. I think that there is going to be some legislative involvement. I think that that was put as a provision in the law to help protect Vermonters. January 1st, though, if you think back a little bit, I think January 1 is too late. I think it has to be backed up at least a month so that we can prepare to take care of folks. I know from personal experience with a company that I co-own, we're facing this ourselves. What are we going to do with our employees? We still haven't decided. But we can't wait until January 1, when if it isn't fully functional, to then say to our employees, what are you doing tomorrow if you have an issue? So I don't think we can wait till January 1 to make this decision. I think there should be benchmarks. And if we don't, and that way we can take some of the politics out of it. If we don't meet a certain goal by a certain date, then I think we should back up and make sure that we protect Vermonters.
So is December 1st, that was the date that Don Turner and Joe Benning mentioned. Is December 1st strike you as a reasonable date?
I think it sounds reasonable to me that a month before, if it's not going to be fully functional, then we have to deal with that reality and then let people know. This has to be transparent. We have to acknowledge when we have some issues, some obstacles, and then act upon that.
Now, the governor says it's too early to talk about a contingency plan because he's trying to fix the problems. Does he have a point that it would be premature to start talking about what if, while you're still trying to get this thing online?
And maybe I understand his position. It's a fine line. He has to make sure that he gives Vermonters enough faith in the project to feel that they're comforted by that. At the same time, I might approach it maybe a little bit differently. I might say that we absolutely do have a plan B or C or D. I actually think we might be in plan B right now with the paper registration. That sounds like a plan B. I think we missed the one benchmark, which was October 1, when this was supposed to be fully up and running. So I think we're in somewhat plan B as we speak. So what are we doing next? And I just think that Vermonters need to be comforted knowing we're going to be okay. We have a plan B or C in mind, and we'll implement that.
So you think he should be a little more specific about that?
I think it would comfort businesses in particular that are facing this. I talk to them every day. There are many companies that are similar to ours that are still wondering what they're going to do. They had hoped maybe to keep their own insurance for a period of time. They're very happy with what they have, but that's not possible. Here in Vermont, we've done something a little bit different. I know nationally the president has stated that if you like your plan, you can keep it. But that's not the case here in Vermont. Any employer with 50 or less employees must allow this to be implemented.
So the company that's helping to set up the Vermont Exchange, known as CGI, has missed a number of deadlines. They're looking at least $5 million in penalties right now. And at his press conference yesterday, the governor said, you know what, we're not going to get into this whole penalty phase right now. We're asking these folks to help us out, to fix the problem. It would be a big mistake to say to them, oh, by the way, we're also going to try to recover at least $5 million in penalties from you at this time. Is that the right approach?
Well, again, as a contractor myself, we have deadlines that we have to make, and some of them are with the state. And when you do that, you either make the deadline or you pay penalties. You pay penalties almost every day. So there are times if that's in the contract, and you know what the drop dead date is, it doesn't matter. We're paying those penalties, and we have to finish the job. I'm sure there was a bond of some sort put up, so to make sure that the end result, the end product, was delivered. And if you, in the contracting world, if you don't meet that date and then you still can't meet it, then you the bond is brought forth and somebody finishes it for you.
So as a contractor, if you're in that kind of situation, and the state or whatever entity is you're involved with imposes a penalty on you while you're working on the project, is that disruptive to you?
No, I think for us it's more of an incentive. We know we have to finish the job one way or the other because the penalty is, and again, I don't know what the contract is. I don't know the specifics, but if it's an everyday type of thing or every week or every month, there's an incentive to finish the project, because if it overwhelms you and you don't finish the project, again, with the bonding, and I'm not sure there was a bond with this, I would hope there was, but if there's a bond that is invoked, then at that point, you're going to go out of business. If your bonding company comes in and takes over the job that you're doing, you're pretty much out of business, because they attach everything you have personally and take over your business at that point.
Let's go to our listeners and talk to Peg in Rutland. Hi, Peg. Welcome to the program.
Well, thank you. And I want to thank the Lieutenant Governor for his usual calm approach and saying, let's not get into a blame game. Let's focus on problem solving. My point today is simply that these large computer systems very often have glitches in them, and I personally experienced one in the healthcare arena this summer when, for a period of about 6 weeks, I had to go every couple of days to my pharmacy to borrow a couple of pills against a prescription because it couldn't be filled, and it turned out, without going into details, that the problem was based on the merger of two very large, I call them mega corporations, in the prescription fulfillment business, and their IT systems weren't able to talk to each other. Without going into detail, that was basically it. So for a six-week period, I was going every couple of days to get a prescription. I had to borrow the pills against my prescription until it could be properly paid for. So this kind of a problem occurs in the business sector, in the large business sector, all the time. And I think that that's something worth thinking about, too, is the broader issues of how much we depend on these very, very large, complex systems, and focusing on how we can do the problem solving and get them all to work better. As anybody who's ever waited for a total of maybe 5 or 6 hours over time trying to take care of a billing problem with, say, Verizon or something like that, is probably aware of how complicated the systems can be to deal with. And I think that we need to keep working on that and not just blame the government for failures there.
Peg, thanks very much for your phone call. You know, the governor talked about this yesterday in the private industry. He'd say, you know, you roll out a big new computer program, there are always glitches. So, you know, it shouldn't be so unexpected.
Well, that's true. And that's what I've, again, consistently talked about since the inception, was that this is a huge endeavor. This is something as biggest thing that we've faced, I think, as a state from a technological standpoint ever. So we may have, maybe we should have planned just a little bit better. Maybe we should have given a little bit more time, maybe not forced 100,000 people into the system by January 1. Maybe there was a better approach to transitioning in terms of anniversary dates and so forth, and maybe given a little bit more time. And again, the difference between Vermont and what's being done nationally is there's a choice nationally that you can keep your plan. Here in Vermont, for a lot of reasons, it's not a choice for us, for most of us. There's 100,000 of us that don't have a choice come January 1. So I think that's the difference. And I agree. I think it can be solved. I think anybody that puts their heads together and works together can solve this issue. The question is, the million-dollar or multi-million-dollar question is, can it be solved by January 1 or before? And what are we going to do in the meantime, or what are we going to do at that point if not?
Today on the program, our guest is Lieutenant Governor Phil Scott. We've been talking about the healthcare exchange, many other issues to talk about. What are your thoughts? 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Some Democratic senators, and the person who comes to mind is Jeanne Shaheen over in the state of New Hampshire, have talked about extending the enrollment period for the Affordable Care Act. Now, New Hampshire is a state that decided not to set up its own exchange, so the federal government is coming in to set that one up. Is that a possible option, just extend enrollment, put things on hold for 3 to 6 months?
Well, that's what I envision, that there is a period of time that we can delay this, and maybe it is 3 months, maybe it's 6 months, whatever it takes to make sure that we get this right and give comfort to Vermonters. The problem, I think, is that I'm not sure that even our insurance company will continue our coverage. There would have to be some negotiations. Now, some would argue that this isn't of a benefit, but we do only have a couple of insurance companies here in the state that we deal with. So to make a deal with them probably wouldn't be that difficult, considering everything we're going through. So I would think that there might be an opportunity where we could just extend that period of time and just roll back the clock just a little bit or roll forward until mid-year and do the same thing again, but allow enough time for all the testing that should have been done probably before we rolled this out to do it now.
Let's go back to our listeners and talk to Don in Richmond. Hi, Don. What's on your mind?
Hi. My quick question was, why did we have to understand that there's a threshold here that has to be held up to in terms of expectations of excellence and testing? If it's at a private arena, there's typically multiple vendors. So if you don't like what the product is or the app surface, you then have a option to go elsewhere. I just want to point out that there is no alternative with the government, so the expectations have to be, I'd say, higher, because we have no elsewhere else to go. It has to work, and it has to work well.
So, Lieutenant Governor, you were talking about perhaps delaying if the government system doesn't work well, as Don was talking about. Do you think you need to wait before you put that delay into place? Are you thinking, okay, let's see where we are December 1st, and if things aren't in place then we put some contingency plan in place, then we talk about delay? Or are you talking about, I think it has to happen right now?
Yeah, I think we have to act fairly soon on this. We remember, this was supposed to be up and going October 1, totally. To date, because of the financial aspect, it isn't working. So the next date was November 1st, and that's fast approaching. If we don't meet that date, we've lost a month. And as I understand it, if we have 100,000 or the other figure is 70,000 because of the anniversary date of some of the policies. But even that, at the rate we're going right now, I think we're going to inundate the system. I don't know if it's physically possible to get everyone enrolled by that date. And so I just want to be realistic, pragmatic. I don't want to paint anybody into a corner. It doesn't have to be. Nobody has to admit defeat. It just means that we have to rethink this and come up with a different approach to make sure that we take care of everybody.
Now, the last time you were on this program, I asked you if you were interested in running for governor in 2014, and you said, you know, I'm really not. It's not on my radar screen. That's not something I'm really considering at all. I'm just wondering, as this issue unfolds, if it turns out that there are severe problems with the rollout of the healthcare exchange and we get to January and February and these things haven't been worked out, is that going to cause you to sort of take another look at 2014, or is that really not an option?
Now, I'll say the same thing that I said before. I think I'm going to stay in my current role. I'm going to run for lieutenant governor again. But I don't want to turn this into another battle. I mean, this is far and too important to at least those 100,000 people that must sign up. And you know, the others aren't far behind. So this is something we're all facing. This is a federal mandate, and we're trying to implement it here in Vermont. We might have done it differently, but that's, you know, the Monday morning quarterback. It's just we probably could have done things differently. But the reality is it's here before us, and I think it's just incumbent upon all of us as leaders to address the problem and try and get through it and not turn it into a political partisan battle.
Today on our program, our guest is Lieutenant Governor Phil Scott. Our phone number, 1-800-639-2211. We've been talking about health care. We're going to talk about the federal shutdown as well as any other issues that you'd like to discuss. 1-800-639-2211. This is Vermont Edition on VPR. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Our guest today is Lieutenant Governor Phil Scott. We've been talking about health care, lots of other issues. 1-800-639-2211 if you'd like to join the conversation. Or you can always send us an email at vermontedition@vpr.net. Let's talk to Mark in Waitsfield. Hi, Mark. Welcome to the program.
Yes, hello. I have just a little interesting perspective from my point of view that I would like to share.
Go right ahead.
I am a middle to low income person, and I have not had health care in the past 7 years until I signed up for VHAP, and I got an adjusted insurance rate and got insurance, and it's costing me $33 a month to be insured. How can I be sure that if I sign up for Obamacare, they're going to keep me at the same rate that I know I can afford without having to come out of pocket and wait for a subsidy on my tax returns?
It's probably a difficult question to answer without a lot of the details.
Right. But I think that that brings up another question that I've had all along. And I know that there are many that say, this is great news for Vermont. We'll be able to sign up for the exchange, and there'll be subsidies available, and there's all this federal money that we're going to be able to take advantage of. And my question, with everything that's going on in Washington, with the sequester and the battles over the budget and so forth, who's to say that we're going to have that money for years to come? Who's to say that those subsidies will be there in place to take care of us? For those that can't afford the insurance, because the prices that came out at first glance, when I saw the prices charged on the exchange, I thought, well, that's not so bad. But when I started looking at the policies themselves, I found out that there were higher deductibles than what we have now. We have an HSA at our company. And when you look at the higher deductible, it wasn't as good a deal as what we have right now. So that's what we're struggling with in my company, to try and give the best product for our employees. And I have to determine whether to let them go on their own or for us to do something as a company. But if we let them go on their own, they can take advantage of subsidies and probably pay less and get a better product. But I don't know about the longevity.
You know, during the recent federal government shutdown, the three members of Vermont's congressional delegation pretty much blamed the House Tea Party Republicans for trying to hold the country hostage to make changes to the Affordable Care Act. And you wrote a piece saying that you thought both sides were wrong and there should be some room for honest negotiations. And some people might be thinking that your position gave some legitimacy to the Tea Party Republicans by saying, you know, they got a point. The Democrats ought to negotiate with them. Is that what you were doing?
No, I just think that once you draw lines in the sand from any position, and I blame, again, I blame everyone somewhat equally here. If you say, I am not going to do this, there's a line in the sand, I'm not going over that. I'm not going to negotiate. And the other side said, well, I'm not going to do whatever. And there's no, and once you start with a public battle like that, and you do it through the media, then somebody's got to win and somebody's got to lose. And that's not the way negotiations work. If you could work some of this out, to talk to one another beforehand, I think a lot of this could have been avoided. And we all lost. And that's the point. I think all of us lost over this. Nobody, there was no winners, it didn't seem like. The president won somewhat the battle, but we as Americans, I think, suffered, I think, greatly over that period of time.
Because the Democrats argued that the Tea Party Republicans chose a pretty bad way to try to negotiate, basically saying, we don't like the Affordable Care Act, even though it's law, even though it's been upheld by the Supreme Court, and the Tea Party Republicans were going to shut the government down if they didn't get their way.
I agree. It was a poor way to do it. I wouldn't, from their standpoint, I think they made a huge mistake. But I think that in Vermont, something like that would not have happened. And that's why I'm looking at this healthcare exchange, what we're facing right now, I don't want to turn it into a DC battle. I want us to work this out, not draw lines in the sand, and figure a way that we can all accomplish what we need. We need affordable healthcare. We need people to feel secure in what they have. We need to let people know a transparent process where they know what's going on, and they can feel comforted that they will have health care come whatever date it is. So this would be an easy one to turn into a partisan political battle, and that's what we have to avoid. We have to avoid what happened there, and that's what I'm encouraging everyone to do.
Different subject. In your other life, you're a professional race car driver. You have a lot of experience when it comes to safety precautions and driving, certainly. Vermont's current blood level for DUI is 0.08. Some people think, you know, it's too high. It ought to come down to something like 0.05. What do you think of that idea?
You know, I think it's different for different people. And impairment in driving, of course, is a tremendous concern. And we need to take people off the road that shouldn't be there in a lot of different arenas, whether it be with electronic devices, or whether it be with substance abuse and so forth. So I'm not. I think 0.08 is something that works. Has been working, and I don't know if that's worth the battle, to tell you the truth.
Do you think people are starting to be impaired at 0.08?
Yes, I think some people are. Yeah, I think it really depends on the person, as we've seen. I mean, we've seen people that are way over that limit that can still function and drive and so forth. But then there are some that might be under that might be impaired. So it's you know, the number is somewhat arbitrary, and I'm not sure that 0.05 gets you there either. You know, it's an interesting debate. I think we'll see if it becomes a bill. I'm not aware that it's being debated in the State House at this point in time or being considered, but we'll see.
Let's go back to our listeners and talk to Arlene in Vergennes. Hi, Arlene. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thank you.
What's on your mind?
I, like, you know, you've been talking, I'm a small employer, and currently I don't insure my employees, but I'm looking into whether I'm going to change that. But one of my employees has tried to sign up for health care, and the cost to her and her husband was going to be a payment amount of over $800 a month, which they definitely could not afford. And so in order to get the subsidy, which they needed to get the insurance down where they could afford, she's got to drop their income level and cut her working hours in half. So by doing that, then she'll be able to get the insurance with a subsidy, but now she can't afford to pay her bills.
Yeah, that's the unfortunate part of a lot of the subsidies that we receive and we offer, is that there's somewhat of a cliff. You fall off if you're eligible or not eligible. It encourages you to do worse, I guess. I'd like to see us inspire and incentivize so that people want to do better. But I understand the issue, and it's, you know, you bring up another point about signing up. You know, if you decide to move forward, even with an insurance plan through your company, you still have to give the employee is the one that's signing up. They will have the option of doing whatever they want. You have to provide a certain amount of money towards that, but they can change their plan from there, from what I understand.
So that example that Arlene gave us of the couple trying to sign up, it might cost $800 a month. That also might be the cost today if they went to get a policy as individuals or couples through that market.
The other problem that I foresee, I'm in the seasonal construction business. We have employees that get laid off during the winter. Typically, in past years, we have covered their insurance through the winter, even while they're collecting unemployment. Now, if they go out on their own, I'm not sure what happens to them. Even if we are going to help, if we let them go on their own, we are still going to help them in some way. But we won't be able to pay them, even if we wanted to, because it would be taken off their unemployment checks one-to-one. So I'm not sure how that's going to work with seasonal workers either, if they can if it'll be a quick turnaround that they can then take advantage of the subsidy on that period at that exact moment, or what happens from there.
We've got just a little bit of time left, but you've been involved in an effort to change the leadership of the Vermont Republican Party. The current chairman of the party, Jack Lindley, has encountered some serious health issues. I think there's some questions as to whether or not he will run for re-election as chairman. But two candidates have emerged, John McGovern, who ran against Bernie Sanders in 2012, and David Sunderland, who's a former House member. Are either of these two candidates more in line with where you think the party needs to go in the future?
Well, I've publicly endorsed David Sunderland at this point. He is somebody that I got to know a number of years ago. He served in the House. I was serving in the Senate. I've always been impressed with the way he treated people, the civility and respect that he's shown. And it's his engineering background, I think, is a structural approach to issues and trying to just accomplish things. And I think that that's, something that the GOP needs to figure out, that we have some problems that we need to address. We need to bring people together and try and do it in a structural way.
Does the party need to distance itself from national Republicans in Washington?
I think what we have to do is make sure that we define who we are. And Vermont Republicans are different than national Republicans. So I don't know about, I guess you naturally distance yourself by setting a tone that's different than what's happening nationally. And I've always tried to do that in my Senate life and as lieutenant governor. I'm probably a different breed of Republican than is found throughout the nation. But I'm comfortable with being associated with those that have served us well over the years, the Aikens, the Staffords, and so forth. I mean, there's a long, long line of pragmatic Republicans that have served the state.
So that'll be coming up as an election for the party chair in the next month or so?
Yes, in November.
Lieutenant Governor Phil Scott, you're involved in many important issues. Many thanks for being on the program today.
Well, thanks very much, and I hope people show up for Wheels from Warmth this weekend. Tire drop-off and tires can be bought and sold tomorrow at Du Bois Construction in Middlesex.
Coming up next, I'll talk with VPR's Jane Lindholm about some of the key issues raised by her mental health care series that ran this week. This is Vermont Edition on VPR. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. All this week, we've been looking at the mental health care system in Vermont and some of the biggest issues that policymakers are grappling with since Tropical Storm Irene flooded out the state hospital in Waterbury. VPR's Jane Lindholm reported the series, and she joins me now. Hi, Jane.
Hey, Bob.
So, Jane, tell us, why did you want to do this series? What were the motivating factors?
Well, we have been hearing a lot about the mental health care system in the state since Tropical Storm Irene, and particularly about the state hospital and what the replacement is going to be for the old state hospital. But the system is so complex, I didn't feel like I had a great handle on what else comprises the mental health care system in this state. Where are patients going who aren't going to the state hospital? What happens to people who are stable but dealing with bipolar disorder and need counseling, or occasionally need an inpatient stay at some place other than a hospital? What happens to them? Where are they going, and what are the resources in the state? So I wanted to take a comprehensive look at the system and break it down, make it a little bit more manageable, and see where the pressure points are.
We know that a new state psychiatric facility is being built in Berlin. Now, that was originally going to open as a 16-bed facility, but the governor has said that it's likely that it will open at its 25-bed capacity next year. Why the change?
Well, Bob, there's a lot of pressure on the system at the moment. Right now, we're seeing people waiting in emergency rooms, sometimes for up to 2 weeks, to get care in psychiatric units around the state. So opening at 25 beds is supposed to alleviate some of that pressure. So once that hospital is actually built, let me break down the numbers for you. There will be 45 beds available in Berlin, Rutland, and Brattleboro. Now, that's actually fewer than the whole state hospital held when it was in service, and there's a lot of concern still that that's not going to be enough beds in the system. What I was finding from the people that I spoke with was that there seems to be a sort of wait-and-see-and-hope approach, because this is the system that's being put in place. This building, this hospital is being built with 25 beds, no more. So there's not much anybody can do to change the system at this point. But one of the issues that hospitals with psychiatric wards say is a problem is that it's more difficult for them to treat the patients who in the past might have gone to the state hospital. So they're not always able to keep their units at full capacity. Now, additionally, the Brattleboro retreat has faced some of the same issues with federal certification that the state hospital faced when it was in service. And Sandra Steingard, who's the medical director at the Howard Center in Burlington, said she thinks other hospitals around the state are really wary of taking on difficult patients if it's likely to threaten their certification. Let me play you a little bit of what Sandy Steingard said to me.
I think it's unfair to ask people to do high-risk work and then to be so highly regulated that if something untoward happens, you know, when you're dealing with high-risk people, bad things may happen, even when you're really good and you're working really hard. And to put a hospital at the brink of losing Medicaid, which could basically put the hospital out of business, I think is unfair to them.
So Dr. Steingard says she sees a lot of reluctance and concern on the part of hospitals. There still seem to be, Bob, a lot of questions about what's going to happen once that new state facility is built and if it's actually going to be enough to treat the patients who are, in some cases, the most sick and often are involuntarily committed, sometimes have been court-ordered into psychiatric treatment.
Jane, for patients who are admitted against their will, treatment can be very complicated, as you explored in the series. You looked at the issue of involuntary medication or forced drugging. Is this likely to come up as an issue in the legislature this winter?
Yeah, absolutely. Governor Shumlin has asked the legislature, actually, to take a look at how long it takes for doctors to be able to forcibly medicate a patient who is refusing treatment. He has said he'd like to see the legislature take this up and shorten the amount of time that it takes. Right now, there are two hearings. So the first hearing is for someone to be officially committed to a psychiatric facility like the Brattleboro retreat. So somebody who has been involuntarily admitted will be in the hospital, but it takes about 30 days for that commitment hearing for the patient to be officially committed, officially starting treatment, even if that patient doesn't want treatment. The second hearing gives the doctors the ability to forcibly medicate the patient with antipsychotics. These are usually administered by injection, not in pill form. And that second hearing can take 30 or up to 60 days. So it can take 90 days for someone who's in the hospital to get medical pharmacological treatment. And the governor and many hospital providers want to see that process shortened. People like Fritz Engstrom, who's medical director at the Brattleboro retreat, say that patients actually get worse the longer they go without treatment, and that having to wait up to 90 days is dangerous for the patients, dangerous for staff and other patients, because these unmedicated patients are sometimes violent, and of course they're dangerous to themselves, which is why they're admitted in the first place. On the flip side of this coin, Bob, are some of the patients who I talk to who have had to have this happen to them. And they say this is an incredible violation of their rights. Their bodies are not their own to do with as they see fit. Some of the patients describe forced drugging, as they call it, as rape. It feels like rape to them. And many of them are against involuntary medication altogether. So this is likely to come up in the legislature in January, as Shumlin has requested. And one of the things the legislature is going to look at is whether or not that commitment hearing and the medication hearing can be combined into one. But here's what Jack McCullough says. He runs the Mental Health Law Project, and he represents the patients in these situations.
As soon as you introduce force into the equation, you make it very much harder for the person to have a trusting relationship with not only the psychiatrist in the hospital, but with the whole mental health system. And that makes people less likely to ask for help when they need it and more likely to avoid the system that they would see has treated them very badly in the past.
So Jack McCullough doesn't want to see the process sped up at all. And Bob, this is a really tricky conversation and a really tricky discussion that the legislature is going to have, because this process does often feel so violating to patients when it's happening. But then you have family members and in some cases patients themselves who have said, boy, when I am incapacitated, unable to determine a course of treatment for myself, it is a good thing to have this medication. So really going to be a tricky situation.
So, Jane, are there some significant issues that you weren't able to address in the series?
Yeah, there are several that I would really like to follow up with. One of them is the role of private practice and independent practitioners. I didn't address that in the series. This was really looking at some of the state systems and where federal and state money go. But private practice is, you know, is really sort of in here at all levels. A lot of psychologists, psychiatrists who are treating patients who need help in the state. And there are some issues around that that I'd like to explore, including the difficulties that they sometimes have in accepting insurance. A lot of providers won't accept any insurance. Another issue that I'd like to look at is the turnover in staffing that some of the mental health agencies in the state face. A lot of the lower level employees, so people who are doing social work, who are helping patients keep their lives together, aren't being paid very well, and there's a lot of turnover. Here's Mark Beattie at the Northeast Kingdom Human Services.
We have a lot of turnover at the entry level for a couple of reasons, I think. One is the pay is not terribly good. It's better than minimum wage, but it's certainly not what I would consider a living wage. So we have folks that come in out of necessity, take the job until they find something that pays better.
That's an issue, Bob, throughout the system, that there is high turnover. In some places, we also have a shortage of psychiatrists to work at these mental health agencies. That's something I'd like to look at in the future.
VPR's Jane Lindholm, many thanks for a great series.
Thank you, Bob.
And you can find our whole series of reports as well as profiles of Vermonters living with mental health issues at vpr.net. A new coalition is promoting modest gun legislation as a matter of public safety. National retailer Dollar General is opening more stores in Vermont. Fish and wildlife officials will count ticks on moose brought into weigh stations. An energy-efficient modular home was unveiled in White River Junction. And the Vermont State Nuclear Advisory Panel wants the Vermont Yankee plant decommissioned promptly after it shuts down next year. These are some of the voices in the news this week.
Vermont happens to be one of the only two states in the nation that doesn't have a state law prohibiting violent felons from possessing weapons. It's the federal law, but we don't reinforce that like other states do with their own state law.
We had a fairly good presence already in Northeast New York, and to extend that into Vermont from a supply chain standpoint made a lot of sense from a business perspective.
So if a moose walks by, the ticks on the end of the cluster grab onto it, and they're all grabbed onto each other, so this huge blob of winter tick larvae, which are the size of a grain of sand, come onto the moose, and then they spread out. Moose usually have 30,000 to 100,000 ticks on.
The deal is that with this home, you can become a net zero home for almost the same money as building a typical everyday modular home.
Prompt decommissioning it seems to me, is a good thing by itself compared to Safe Store. And so that should be encouraged.
You can find links to these stories at our website, vpr.net. That's our program for today. I'm Bob Kinzel.
And I'm Jane Lindholm. Monday on the program, World Series Fever. Right now, it's even through two games. But by Monday, our panel of sports journalists should have a better idea of how this classic matchup might end. And you can let us know what you think of the Cards and the Sox. Send your emails about the World Series to vermontedition@vpr.net. Our producers are Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sage Van Wing. We have production assistance from Tim Johnson. Peter Biello directed the show, and our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. Have a great weekend.